Imagine you are a new arrival in a country. You have crossed borders, learned a new language, and started to build a new life. One day, a letter arrives. It tells you that you have been granted citizenship. You feel something shift inside you. This is not just a piece of paper. It is a relationship. It is a contract between you and the state you now belong to. From this moment on, the state promises to protect certain things about your life. And in return, you promise certain things back. This is the heart of what we call citizenship, and understanding it is one of the most important things any person living in a modern society can do. Let us begin at the beginning. Citizenship is the formal relationship between a person and the state. Think of it like a membership in a very serious club. The club, in this case, is the country. As a member, you receive certain benefits and protections, but you also have duties. You cannot simply take the benefits and ignore the duties, any more than a member of a football team can enjoy the trophy without showing up to the matches. This idea sounds simple, but it has taken human beings thousands of years, countless arguments, wars, and revolutions to work out what exactly those benefits and duties should be. And even today, in the 21st century, people disagree fiercely about the details. A British thinker named T.H. Marshall wrote a very important essay in 1950. He looked at the history of citizenship in modern societies and noticed something interesting. The rights that citizens enjoy did not all arrive at once. They came in three separate waves across different centuries, each wave building on the last. He called these three types civil rights, political rights, and social rights. Let us look at each one carefully, because they shape almost everything about how modern governments work. Civil rights were the first to arrive. These are the rights that protect your personal freedom. They are the walls that stop the government or other people from interfering with your life in certain fundamental ways. Civil rights include the freedom to say what you think, to follow the religion you choose, to own property, and to be treated fairly by the legal system if you are accused of a crime. Think about what it means to have the right to a fair trial. In many countries throughout history, if you were accused of a crime, a powerful person could simply decide you were guilty, and that was that. There was no independent judge, no jury of ordinary people, no right to defend yourself. The English Magna Carta of 1215 began to push back against this kind of raw power. Centuries later, the United States added the first 10 amendments to its constitution, known as the Bill of Rights, in 1791. These amendments explicitly stated that the government could not take away your freedom of speech, your freedom of religion, or your right to a fair legal process. The French Revolution produced a similar document in 1789, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, which declared boldly that all men are born free and equal in rights. Now, here is something important to notice. Civil rights are mainly about freedom from interference. They tell the government and other people what they cannot do to you. They are protective walls around your individual life, but they say very little about whether you get to help decide how the country is run. That is where the second wave of rights comes in. Political rights are the rights that allow you to participate in power. The most obvious example is the right to vote. Others include the right to run for public office yourself, or to join a political party. These rights are the tools of democracy, which is a system of government where ordinary people have a say in who leads them and what laws are made. Here is the uncomfortable truth about political rights, however. For most of modern history, they were given only to a narrow group of people. In many countries, you had to own property to vote. The idea behind this was that only people with something to lose, something tied to the land, could be trusted with political power. This meant that vast numbers of ordinary working people, no matter how intelligent or responsible, had no voice in government at all. And women, for almost all of history everywhere in the world, were simply excluded. The struggle to change this is one of the great stories of human progress. In the United Kingdom, women began fighting seriously for the right to vote in the late 1800s. Some of these women, known as suffragettes, used dramatic tactics. They chained themselves to railings, went on hunger strikes in prison, and disrupted political meetings. The movement faced enormous opposition. Critics said women were too emotional for politics or that their place was in the home. Finally, in 1918, women over 30 who met certain property requirements gained the right to vote in Britain. Full equal voting rights came in 1928 with the Representation of the People Act. In the United States, the 19th Amendment granted women the right to vote in 1920. For many women alive at the time, this represented a lifetime of struggle finally rewarded. The point of this story is not just historical. It is a reminder that the political rights we may take for granted today were not gifts. They were won, often at great personal cost, by people who refused to accept that they were lesser citizens. The third wave of rights is the most modern and the most debated. These are social rights. Social rights are entitlements to a certain basic standard of living. They include the right to education, to healthcare, to housing, and to social security, which means support from the government when you are old, sick, or unable to work. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, adopted by the United Nations in 1948, includes social rights. It states that everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of themselves and their family. This sounds reasonable and even obvious when you read it, but it immediately raises a difficult question. If you have a right to healthcare, that means the government has a duty to provide it. That costs money. Where does that money come from? It comes from taxes. And this is exactly where modern political arguments begin. Countries like Sweden, Germany, and Canada have built what are called welfare states. This term, which simply means a government that takes responsibility for the basic well-being of its citizens, involves high taxes and comprehensive public services. Citizens in these countries generally receive free or very affordable healthcare, generous unemployment support, and heavily subsidized university education. In the United States, the picture is very different. There, the debate about whether healthcare is a right or a commodity, meaning something you buy and sell like any other product, has been running loudly and bitterly for decades. The argument is fundamentally about how much responsibility the state owes the individual and how much responsibility each individual owes themselves. This is not a debate with a simple right answer. It touches on deep questions about fairness, freedom, and the purpose of government itself. Now we turn to the other side of the contract. We have talked about what the state owes the citizen. What does the citizen owe the state? Some duties are not optional. They are enforced by law, and if you refuse them, there are consequences. The most obvious legal duty is to obey the law. This seems almost too simple to mention, but it is actually profound. When you agree to live within a society, you implicitly agree to accept its rules, even rules you personally disagree with, because a society where everyone simply ignores the laws they dislike would fall apart very quickly. The philosopher John Locke called this a social contract. You give up some of your complete personal freedom in exchange for the security and benefits of living in an organized community. Paying taxes is another legal duty. Taxes might feel like the government taking your money, but think about what that money buys. Roads, hospitals, schools, police, fire services, courts, the military that defends the border. None of these things would exist if every individual had to pay for them privately. Taxes are the price of living in a functioning society, though of course how much tax is fair and how that money should be spent are again enormous political debates. In many countries, jury duty is another legal obligation. This means that ordinary citizens can be called to sit in a courtroom and decide, together, whether a person accused of a crime is guilty or innocent. The idea behind this is powerful. It means that justice is not just in the hands of professional judges or government officials. It belongs to the community itself. In the United States, the right to be judged by a jury of one's peers is protected by the Constitution, and the duty to serve on that jury when called is the other side of that right. Some countries go even further and require military service. South Korea, Switzerland, and Israel, among others, have laws saying that young people, usually young men, must serve in the armed forces for a period of time. In South Korea, this is partly because of the ongoing tension with North Korea. The argument is that the defense of the nation is not just the job of professional soldiers. It is a duty shared by all citizens. But there is another whole category of responsibilities that are not legally required. Yet many people and most political thinkers consider them just as important. These are the voluntary duties of citizenship, sometimes called civic virtues. Voting is the most discussed example. In most democracies, no one forces you to vote. You have the right to vote, but you also have the right to stay home. And yet, think about what happens when large numbers of people choose not to vote. Governments get elected by smaller and less representative portions of the population. Policies are shaped by whoever did bother to show up, which is often older, wealthier, more organized groups of people. The voices of the young, the poor, and the disengaged go unheard, not because anyone silenced them, but because they silenced themselves. Some countries, like Australia and Belgium, have responded to this by making voting compulsory, meaning legally required. Australia has done this since 1924 and consistently achieves voter turnout above 90%. The debate about whether this is a good idea is genuinely interesting. On one side, you might say that forcing people to vote produces more representative governments and encourages citizens to become informed. On the other side, you might argue that in a free society, the right not to vote is just as valid as the right to vote, and that forced participation without genuine engagement is meaningless. Staying informed is another civic virtue. A democracy can only work well if its citizens have some basic knowledge about what their government is doing. This does not mean everyone needs to be a political expert, but it does mean making an effort to read or watch reliable news, to understand the major issues facing your community and country, and to think critically rather than simply accepting the first thing you read or hear. In the modern world, with information flowing everywhere at all times, this is both easier and harder than it has ever been. Easier because information is everywhere. Harder because so much of that information is misleading, incomplete, or outright false. Community involvement is a third civic virtue. This can be as local and modest as volunteering at a food bank, joining a neighborhood group, or helping at a school. It can also be larger, like organizing a campaign to clean up a park or raise money for a local cause. The political philosopher Alexis de Tocqueville, a Frenchman who traveled to the United States in the 1830s and wrote about what he saw, was fascinated by the American habit of forming voluntary associations, meaning groups of citizens who came together to solve problems without waiting for the government to act. He believed this was one of the greatest strengths of democratic societies. When citizens take responsibility for their communities, they build what scholars today call social capital, which simply means the trust, networks, and shared values that hold a community together and make it function well. Now let us talk about how citizens actually engage with the political system. Political scientists, who are academics who study how power works in society, generally divide political participation into two types. They call these conventional and unconventional participation. Conventional participation means doing things through the normal, accepted channels of democracy. Voting is the obvious example, but it also includes writing a letter or email to your local representative, donating money to a political campaign, joining a political party, attending a public meeting where officials answer questions from citizens, and joining interest groups. Interest groups are organizations formed around a specific issue or concern, which then try to influence government policy. The environmental group Greenpeace, for example, lobbies governments on climate policy. The National Rifle Association in the United States lobbies on gun rights. These groups gather the voices and resources of many individual citizens and focus them on specific policy goals. Unconventional participation means going outside the normal channels. This includes protests and demonstrations, where large numbers of people gather publicly to express a political view. It includes boycotts, where people refuse to buy a product or use a service to put pressure on a company or government. And it includes civil disobedience, which is a very specific and important concept that deserves careful explanation. Civil disobedience means deliberately breaking a law that you believe is unjust, openly and without violence, and accepting the legal punishment that follows. The purpose is not to escape punishment. It is to draw public attention to the injustice of the law itself and to put moral pressure on the government to change it. The American writer Henry David Thoreau wrote about this idea in 1849. The Indian independence leader Mahatma Gandhi turned it into a powerful political strategy in the early 20th century, leading campaigns of nonviolent resistance against British rule in India. Gandhi taught his followers to accept arrest and imprisonment without fighting back. The goal was to demonstrate the moral contradiction of the British government claiming to stand for civilization while imprisoning people simply for making their own salt or wearing their own cloth. Gandhi's methods directly inspired one of the most important political movements of the 20th century, the American Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s and 1960s. This movement is worth understanding in some detail because it is perhaps the finest example in recent history of citizenship in action at every level. African Americans in the United States, even after the end of slavery following the Civil War in the 1860s, continued to face systematic, state-sponsored discrimination. In the southern states, a set of laws known as Jim Crow laws enforced racial segregation, meaning the forced separation of black and white people in schools, restaurants, buses, public bathrooms, and almost every aspect of daily life. Beyond that, African Americans were prevented from exercising their political rights through a series of cruel tactics. Poll taxes meant you had to pay money to vote, and most black citizens were kept too poor to afford it. Literacy tests were administered unfairly, with impossible questions given to black applicants and easy ones to white applicants. Violence and intimidation were used against anyone who tried to register to vote. The response of African American citizens and their allies was a masterclass in multi-layered civic engagement. On the conventional side, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, known as the NAACP, pursued legal challenges through the courts for decades. Their greatest victory came in 1954, when the United States Supreme Court ruled in the case of Brown v. Board of Education that segregated schools were unconstitutional. This single court ruling began to dismantle the entire legal structure of segregation. On the unconventional side, citizens organized actions of extraordinary courage. In December 1955, a woman named Rosa Parks, in Montgomery, Alabama, refused to give up her bus seat to a white passenger as the law required. She was arrested. In response, the African American community of Montgomery organized a boycott of the city's buses that lasted 381 days. An entire community, many of whom depended on those buses to get to work, chose to walk, carpool, and sacrifice rather than accept humiliation. The boycott worked. Eventually, the Supreme Court ruled that segregation on buses was unconstitutional. In 1960, young black students began sitting at segregated lunch counters in Woolworth's stores, places where they were legally forbidden to eat. They sat quietly and politely while white customers and sometimes staff screamed at them, poured drinks on them, and physically attacked them. They did not fight back. They simply sat. These sit-ins spread to dozens of cities.
In 1963, hundreds of thousands of people marched on Washington and there on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. A young Baptist minister named Martin Luther King Jr. delivered a speech that has echoed through history ever since, calling for a nation where people would be judged not by the color of their skin but by the content of their character. The sustained combination of legal action, economic boycott, peaceful protest, and moral courage produced results. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 banned discrimination in public places. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 struck down the barriers preventing African Americans from voting. These were not gifts from a generous government.
they were victories won by citizens who understood their rights, accepted their responsibilities, and engaged with extraordinary courage and creativity.
The civil rights movement raises a question that political philosophers have wrestled with for centuries.
When is it right to break the law?
Most of the time, we rightly say that citizens should obey the law, even laws they disagree with, because a society where everyone breaks laws they personally dislike cannot function.
But what about a law that is itself profoundly unjust? What about a law that denies some citizens their basic humanity?
Martin Luther King addressed this directly in his famous letter from Birmingham Jail, written in 1963. He argued that there is a difference between just laws and unjust laws, and that a person has not only the right but the moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws, provided they do so openly, lovingly, and with willingness to accept the penalty.
The willingness to accept punishment, King argued, is what separates civil disobedience from mere lawbreaking.
It demonstrates respect for the rule of law even while challenging a specific law.
This is not a comfortable or easy answer. It requires each person to exercise their own moral judgment, which is difficult and can be done badly as well.
But it is an honest recognition that laws are made by human beings, that human beings make mistakes, and that sometimes citizenship requires courage. The digital revolution has opened entirely new dimensions to political engagement. Social media platforms like Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram allow millions of people to share information, organize protests, and pressure governments with speed that would have been unimaginable 30 years ago. The Arab Spring of 2010 and 2011, when citizens across the Middle East rose up against authoritarian governments, was partly organized through social media. The hashtag Black Lives Matter began on social media after the killing of Trayvon Martin in 2012 and grew into a global movement for racial justice. Online petitions can gather millions of signatures overnight and force parliaments to debate issues.
But the digital world also creates serious dangers for civic life. Misinformation, which is false information spread accidentally, and disinformation, which is false information spread deliberately to deceive, travel at extraordinary speed online.
A lie can circle the world several times before the truth has finished tying its shoes, as someone once said.
Social media platforms often use mathematical formulas, called algorithms, which sort and show you content based on what you have engaged with before.
The result is that many people end up in what are called echo chambers, spaces where they only ever encounter opinions that agree with their own existing beliefs. This makes it much harder to think carefully about difficult questions, and much easier to see people who disagree with you as foolish or evil rather than as fellow citizens with a different perspective.
Online harassment is another serious problem.
When people can attack others anonymously and at no personal cost, the natural human restraint that governs face-to-face conversation often disappears.
Women, minority groups, and people who take unpopular positions often face torrents of abuse simply for speaking publicly. This can effectively silence voices, particularly those who are already marginalized, and impoverish public debate.
Scholars who study democracy are currently having some very interesting arguments about what it means to be a good citizen in the modern world.
One debate is about what we might call the dutiful citizen versus the engaged citizen.
The dutiful citizen is someone who follows the rules, pays their taxes, votes in elections, and obeys the law.
They are reliable, responsible, and respectful of authority.
The engaged citizen does all of this but goes further. They actively question the government, participate in protests and social movements, challenge unjust laws, and see democracy as something that needs constant tending rather than something that simply runs by itself. Most scholars argue that a healthy democracy needs both types, and that an excess of either one alone creates problems.
A society of only dutiful citizens, who never question authority, can slide into obedience to tyranny.
A society of only perpetually outraged protesters, who respect no rules or institutions, can slide into chaos. Another debate concerns what is called differentiated citizenship.
Standard citizenship says that all citizens have the same rights and the same duties.
but in practice, many societies contain minority groups, such as indigenous peoples, linguistic minorities like the Francophone community in Canada, or ethnic minorities who face distinct challenges that standard citizenship does not address. Some scholars argue that these groups should have additional specific rights to protect their culture, language, and way of life above and beyond the standard rights of all citizens. Others argue that giving different rights to different groups is itself a form of inequality. This is a genuinely difficult question without a clear answer, and different democracies have resolved it in different ways. Perhaps the most ambitious idea in modern thinking about citizenship is global citizenship. The challenges facing humanity today, including climate change, pandemics, mass migration, nuclear weapons, and global inequality, do not stop at national borders. No single nation can solve them alone. Does this mean that citizens have responsibilities not just to their own country, but to humanity as a whole? The idea of global citizenship suggests that the answer is yes. It suggests that we are all, in some sense, members of a single human community, with duties to one another that transcend the accident of where we were born. This idea is powerful and appealing, but it is also deeply contested. Critics point out that democracy works best at the level of specific communities with shared identities and institutions, and that vague duties to all of humanity can become an excuse for neglecting specific duties to your actual neighbors and fellow citizens. These debates are not merely academic. They are arguments about the world we want to live in, about who we owe something to, and about what kind of people we choose to be. Let us now bring together the key ideas from this lesson. Citizenship is a relationship between a person and a state, involving both rights and responsibilities. The British sociologist T.H. Marshall identified three types of rights that have developed over modern history. Civil rights protect personal freedom, such as freedom of speech, religion, and fair treatment under the law. Political rights allow citizens to participate in power, most importantly through voting, and their expansion to include women and racial minorities was a long and difficult struggle. Social rights guarantee a basic standard of living, including education and healthcare, and remain the most debated category because they require the state to actively spend money and make choices about collective responsibility. Citizens also have duties. Some are legal requirements, such as obeying laws, paying taxes, and serving on juries. Others are voluntary civic virtues, such as voting, staying informed, and contributing to community life. Political engagement can be conventional, working through elections, political parties, and official channels, or unconventional, using protests, boycotts, and civil disobedience. The American Civil Rights Movement showed powerfully how both types of engagement together can change a nation. The digital age has created new tools for civic participation, but also new dangers, including misinformation and echo chambers. Finally, scholars continue to debate fundamental questions about citizenship. What makes a good citizen? Should all citizens have exactly the same rights? And do our responsibilities extend beyond our own borders to the wider human family? These questions do not have easy answers, but the act of asking them seriously, thinking about them honestly, and being willing to engage with those who see them differently is itself one of the highest expressions of what it means to be a citizen.